And thanks for joining us for another edition of Psychedelic Breakthrough Addiction Therapies. And I am joined, of course, with our host of our program, Dr. Deborah Mash. And today, we're going to go ahead and discuss a recent article from the New York Times, who surprisingly has taken a lot of time and effort to go ahead and report on the latest interest in Ibogaine and possibly seeing Ibogaine used for treatment for various abnormalities here in the United States. And the article is titled Powerful Psychedelic Gains Renewed Attention as a Treatment for Opioid Addiction. And Dr. Mash, I know that one of the initial points of the program is to talk about how treatments like Ibogaine are addiction disruptors. And that's one of the areas we're going to go look at here. And the New York Times did the courtesy of also featuring you in the article. And we were just talking before we got on the air about how often when Ibogaine is brought up, your name is also brought up in the same conversation for the amount of years you have spent studying this treatment and what it's been able to do in terms of what the New York Times says, help ease the agony of detox and prevent relapse.
Well, thank you for that introduction and pointing out the recent article today, which indeed was, an exceptional overview of where Ibogaine is right in this moment. And for our listeners, Ibogaine has been in the eye of the FDA, the eye of patients and family members desperate for an alternative to current addiction treatments and therapies that are available for them that are standard of care for over 30 years. And it was 30 years ago, almost to the day, when I had the opportunity to go to the Netherlands and to see an Ibogaine treatment with my own eyes. And seeing is believing, and that is captured in this article. Fast forward, where are we today? Where are we today? We are faced with an epidemic of opioid abuse. We're faced with an epidemic of methamphetamine abuse, and we're faced with an epidemic of more and more people trying more and more addicting substances like fentanyl, which is a powerful, powerful, more potent opioid that frequently leads to death. We estimate today that it's a chemical weapon attack on our country. What do I mean? I mean, it's the equivalent of a plane crashing day. The standard of care, getting more medications into clinical trials, making more treatment available to more people who are desperate. We're not there. We are simply not there. We're not there. And this is something that I labor with. This is something that weighs heavy on my heart because I see people who are able to leave the country. Ibogaine, as we know, and my listeners may know, but new listeners may not know, is not available for patients in the United States. It's not an approved drug. What does that mean? It means people need to leave the United States. They need to go to countries where basically it's unregulated. FDA hasn't approved the drug. It is considered an investigational medication. So here's all this publicity, and it's been nonstop publicity. And there's a new momentum, and we'll talk about that shortly. But patients don't have a lot of options. And that's the part that weighs on me, because patients should have alternatives. And Ibogaine is one of those alternatives that I believe, as you say, it's an addiction disruptor. It's an addiction interrupter. It gives patients the freedom to start over and to face another day drug-free and to make the right decisions.
You talk about the momentum. Not only did the New York Times write that story, but the same writer, Andrew Jacobs, also wrote another story to give a full understanding of Ibogaine, where it comes from, the legalities of that medicine out there. And one of the things is that they make a point about with Ibogaine, it's a bit difficult to go ahead and acquire because of the fact that it's from the Iboga tree, a rainforest shrub native in Central Africa. They talk about how it's been used in Africa for a long time. French and Belgian explorers in the 19th century were able to go and acquire, bring it to other areas, and it's shown a lot of promise. Now, the momentum you just mentioned, the New York Times, the paper of record, okay, one of the most aforementioned publications in the world, taking two major stories here on Ibogaine on the same day. Is that surprising, coincidental? Why would you think that that kind of press would be put out there now for Ibogaine all of a sudden?
That's a good question. There are multiple aspects, and I think one being the problem that we just discussed, the fact that we're not winning the war. We're not winning the war, and people are dying. Two, there is the renaissance of psychedelic therapies. A lot of excitement around MDMA and what has been accomplished under the leadership of Rick Doblin and the MAPS team. And that, of course, is being used and developed for post-traumatic stress disorder, for treating the traumas that plague people and change the quality of life and lock people into maladaptive patterns of behavior. So that's the MDMA story. Compass Pathways, charging fast ahead with the development of fully synthetic psilocybin as a pharmaceutical medicine to be made available for patients in the United States. And on that tailwind, I believe, among other molecules that are being tested in rigorous clinical trials, would be that next big advance. And then the science coming from Stanford, the science coming from the seminal work of Goldolin, and the work with our veterans. Imagine that our veterans are providing these powerful, powerful testimonials. And unlike the stigma of addiction, where people are afraid to step out and say, hey, I've been addicted to dope, I've been addicted to crack, I've been in jail, I've lost my family. All of that stigma, it's very difficult when you get clean to put that face forward. Our veterans are veterans, people who keep us safe and as Americans who are in desperate need because of their service to our country. When they stand up, people listen. And I think that's the remarkable new tailwind that we're getting for the Ibogaine story, because veterans are giving very powerful testimonials. They're talking about how Ibogaine saved their lives. And, you know, I have said many times over and over again, there is no cure. You know, there is no cure. We can put health, mental health disorders in remission, and we can start to rewire the brain. And that's another exciting part of this story, is the neuroscience. You know, I'm a neuroscientist, neuropharmacologist, and some of my greatest joy these days are reading new scientific publications coming from the very best laboratories. And indeed, the work of Nolan Williams and his team under his leadership at Stanford, the work that they did following a cohort of 30 patients, veterans, who had traumatic brain injury, suffered from trauma. I think half of that cohort also may have been abusing or misusing alcohol to self-medicate. And the results, again, open label studies, not double blind, random controlled clinical trials, but open label studies, and these powerful testimonials demonstrate that Ibogaine has very significant benefits for patients.
The military study that you make mention of, they talk about the fact of how in that study they went through and they were able to filter out 30 military veterans with special operations forces experience. So the most possible extremes of, you know, PTSD and any various post-traumatic conditions. And they experience clinically meaningful levels of disability, PTSD, depression, and anxiety. And in the study, again, 30 soldiers that had gone through the front lines, and in the journal Nature Medicine, they found out that military veterans with these brain injuries under a single ibogaine therapy session experienced marked improvements in disability, psychiatric symptoms, and cognition. And this is another study that goes outside of substance abuse. This is, I mean, again, another exploring in a different direction and furthering, you know, the importance and the need for more research like this.
And that's all I've ever wanted. That has been my mission from day one, was when I went to the FDA and we gained their cooperation, and the FDA was incredibly collaborative and supportive and helpful to us. Why didn't the science go faster forward under my effort? Because we couldn't get the funding. So then they mention in the article about the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And, you know, my track record with getting ibogaine funding through NIDA was just short of pathetic. In fact, none. And that's not to say that I can't get grants, because I've held uninterrupted NIH funding for many decades, and the NIH, and in fact, NIDA as well, have been very good to me as an academic investigator. So I was able to fund other research. You know, I was the former founder and director of the University of Miami Brain Endowment Bank, one of the largest biorepositories of human brain tissues donated for research after death. And those tissues have been shared with investigators, NIDA-funded investigators, people in biotech and industry, to help bring about breakthroughs for many different diseases, from neurodegeneration to addiction and psychiatry. The reason that I started that effort was because it was clear to me that, you know, looking at disorders of the nervous system are complicated. You've got genetics, you've got environment, you've got development and neurosynapses that are talking to each other. You know, we have more neurons and neural connections in our brain than we have stars in the Milky Way galaxy. That's how complicated it is. And over the decades that I had the privilege to call myself a neuroscientist, we've seen amazing breakthroughs, and many of them funded by the NIH and the National Institute on Drug Abuse. However, look at the number of new medications that have come through the pipeline. They're not there. We have a repurposing of buprenorphine, methadone, which is a very old molecule, and you've got Shantex for smoking. Where are the drugs? Why is it that, and you know, many of the seminal discoveries that spearhead the drug development pipeline come from the academic laboratories, like my own laboratory at the University of Miami, and the collaborators we had. Our work with ibogaine led us to the discovery of noribogaine, an active non-hallucinogenic metabolite that we're very excited about advancing right now as a straight-up pharmaceutical, a molecule that you could take every day to do what? To help to normalize brain chemistry, to eliminate cravings and desire to go back out and get high, but also possibly to turn on this window of neuroplasticity that the psychedelic medicines do so well. So here would be noridogaine, an ibogaine metabolite, non-hallucinogen, non-psychedelic, in the mix as a new molecule, as part of a new class of drug substances. I think all of that is what puts the high beams on the topic of ibogaine, which have been now wonderfully presented in the article in the New York Times.
When you talk about what the National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA, or which is part of the National Institutes of Health, They have been doing some studies, but it's been not on humans, but on ibogaine analogs, so chemically related compounds. They're not taking the chance to go ahead and put humans under any random blind tested controlled trials. They're not even going to go to that route yet. But there's been, you know, the director there has mentioned, Dr. Nora Volko has mentioned being intrigued by the anti-addiction potential. And you mentioned just now methadone, buprenorphine, and some of these older, you know, treatments that have been around for a long time. And by now, there should have been some other new possibilities or some other new treatments that should be out there to help some very rampant, I would almost say, epidemics that we have when it comes to addiction, when it comes to people just trying to be able to go and wean off of various vices that they've come through when it comes to addiction, drugs or alcohol or what have you. But do you feel like that, I mean, are there other extenuating circumstances? Let's just say big pharma. Do you feel like there might be some of these agencies, you know, that's on them to be able to go ahead and hear people like yourself, you know, accredited, experienced, and you know, it's enough research, enough reason why not to go and pursue trials and do more research on this. But do you feel like there are those extenuating circumstances that are being in the ear of NIDA and NIH that is precluding the possibilities of further ibogaine research?
You know, I think there's a lot of different extenuating circumstances. And keep in mind, too, that the NIH NIDA has to fund a lot of different research programs. I mean, it's not just one molecule, and they have a limited budget. And indeed, we would love to see Congress put more money, you know, to do kind of a Manhattan Project to really, you know, increase the funding, the federal research dollars that NIDA has to distribute to qualified researchers and in academia and also in the technology space. We need more money. That's one. We have a limited pool of money, and they have to make critical decisions on how to spend it. I think that's a factor. Also, you know, ibogaine has had some risks associated with it, which I think slow track development. It's very difficult to get patents around an old molecule. So the pharmaceutical industry isn't going to take a chance. When you look at the amount of money that's spent on getting a drug from the bench, from the lab, from a drug discovery program, in other words, a new chemical entity where you can have patent coverage, not only patent exclusivity from your clinical trial, but real patent coverage that will allow you to recoup your investment, it's difficult with ibogaine. And that's why I think Dr. Volko and others have, you know, been focusing on the new molecules that people are synthesizing around the lead molecule, which is ibogaine, and also around the lead molecule, which is noribogaine. And I've had a chance to, you know, read the scientific literature and to know who are some of the leaders in this space right now. And I think there are some very exciting developments. I will tell you that my understanding that some of the molecules that are being developed, which are being tested now in animals, and some may be near ready for human testing, may hold great promise. And these analogs are likely not going to be psychedelic. They're not going to have the intensive therapy that needs to go with administering ibogaine. Right now, we believe that ibogaine, and this is my opinion, I'll say this as my opinion alone, that we know that ibogaine needs to be administered in the context of drug detoxification under full medical monitor. That means there needs to be very highly skilled individuals who know how to administer the drug safely, because ibogaine may have a somewhat more narrow therapeutic to toxic window. Because ibogaine has not been administered in, what shall we call it, in with credentialed physicians, with people who understand the limitations of ibogaine as an investigational medicine, who haven't really studied it in terms of looking at blood levels or understanding the complex metabolism around ibogaine, then people have gotten in trouble. And also desperate people who, you know, you come in after you've been out using hard drugs and alcohol, and you take a dose of ibogaine, your heart may be damaged, your liver enzymes may be elevated, your electrolytes in your blood, what do I mean, your potassium and your magnesium may be off. And that's a bad combination of factors. If you're coming in sick and you're going to take ibogaine, which is a drug that is cardiovascularly active, not only is it acting on the brain, but it also has effects on the heart. You need to be with someone who can read your labs, can look at your cardiogram, and help you make a decision. Okay, are you a great candidate for this? Or perhaps can we refer you to something else? So patients are going outside and taking the risk. They're buying ibogaine on the internet. They're buying impure ibogaine. God only knows what they're buying, actually, because I don't believe it's coming with a, you know, a reputable certificate of analysis. So it's really a buyer beware situation, but people are desperate. And I think if, again, you read at the end of the article said, the young person who was interviewed in the article said, I needed a miracle. And the people who need that miracle are willing to put themselves in unsafe settings to get that miracle. I want that to end. We need the stakeholders. We need the leadership of the NIH and IAAA and the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We need the stakeholders. We need the American Society of Addiction Medicine. We need the practitioners, the doctors, the patients, the consumers, the families. And yes, we need the real world evidence to bring this together like we tried to do in Kentucky, and that got derailed. But maybe there's a second chapter here in the great state of Ohio. We need, what I'm saying is, we need a public-private partnership to make this work.
There's a couple of things I want to unpack out of that. So when it comes to what the big, large commercial pharmaceutical companies will want to do, where they want to go ahead and be able to possibly push back or, you know, pause on the possibilities of ibogaine treatment being researched and getting further along in trials, you know, if they can't crush into a pill or blend it into a topical to dispense, then they're going to want to hold off on anyone else being able to do that in the meantime. You also mentioned when it comes to ibogaine that, you know, you mentioned in the article, they actually quoted you saying that it's not a silver bullet, that it, but it's one of the best interrupters there are out there is ibogaine. One of the side effects that would be, that should be looked at, which is why you mentioned the point of someone really reading your labs and really understanding before you're put under this treatment, that there could be side effects of the heart. One of the things they talk about is cardiac arrhythmia as one of those possible factors. Now, I want to take one other thing that's being brought up in here from the military study. I wanted to just make sure I didn't lose out on this. In that study, they also make the point, if we dig deeper into it, is that when they administered ibogaine, they also co-administered magnesium. I want to just get your take if that was something that was with any surprise to see that in the study and why they decided to go ahead and include that in the treatment.
No, magnesium is important for preventing a fatal arrhythmia. And in fact, in the work that I did originally in St. Kitts, we administered magnesium to all patients who underwent ibogaine. And perhaps that was part of the reason that we didn't have an ibogaine-related fatality. No one went to the hospital. We didn't have severe arrhythmias in our study. But there's another pearl, I think, in the study from Nolan Williams, and that is that he says that they did not see what we call QT prolongation. QT prolongation has to do with the refractory period of the heart. And it, as it lengthens, you can be prone to an arrhythmia. They report that they did not see this. And we know that ibogaine can cause QT prolongation. The question is, how bad is it? What's the magnitude of it? And how much risk is inherent in that QT prolongation? Methadone is a drug that causes QT prolongation. There are molecules approved as medicines that cause QT prolongation. Millions of doses of them are prescribed and administered to patients. We believe, and we've always believed, that if you do the treatment correctly, you can mitigate the risk. And magnesium is an obvious risk mitigation part of that strategy.
I want to ask one other question when it comes to the importance of ibogaine and why, how much of it stands out compared to other treatments of psychedelics. Because in the article here from the New York Times, they make the point about other various treatments, MDMA, psilocybin, and others for all various normalities. And ketamine also, we've heard quite a bit, a lot of infusion clinics being popped up all over the country as it's being allowed more. And various of these treatments being classified so that they can be administered, you know, with proper supervision. What is it about ibogaine that stands out more, that all of a sudden from here, what is it about ibogaine that really stands out as a standalone treatment above and beyond maybe what some of these other treatments are able to do, that which is why you are focused on it so much, or you have been focused on it for so long?
I mentioned seeing is believing. And so when you see a patient take a single dose of ibogaine and become completely detoxed in a short amount of time, not craving and not expressing the desire to go back out and get high again, with one dose of the drug, you know there's got to be something profoundly unique about the mechanism of action of the drug and what it's doing to affect the brain to have beneficial after effects. And that's what got me intrigued as a scientist to begin with. And that's what led us to the discovery of an active metabolite of ibogaine, noribogaine, which we are involved in developing at a clinical trial level now. And we'll be starting a multiple ascending dose study to test that hypothesis in the not too distant future. But I think the understanding what ibogaine does in comparison to other psychedelic molecules, the serotonergic psychedelics, as well as ketamine, is that it's doing something on a bigger scale. And that's the work, the seminal research on the reopening of the period of social reward that's being advanced by a brilliant, brilliant neuroscientist, clinician neuroscientist, Dr. Gold Dolan. And if I encourage my readers to really follow her, she has podcasts on the internet. You can search for this. This is really explaining perhaps why ibogaine is so transformative for patients. And what it also, I think, gives us a glimpse of is something we observed in St. Kitts. When at St. Kitts, my listeners may not know this, but I started the first, I believe it is, was the first psychedelic clinic, government approved, where patients could come to us, sign an informed consent, and then take ibogaine under full medical monitor and work with our therapists and our psychiatrists and our clinicians. So we were learning. It was a research and development laboratory embedded in a treatment setting. And that was perhaps some of the best work that I've ever done in my life, and it was a privilege to work with patients and wonderful clinicians who contributed. But what was really exciting to me and to my therapist was the fact that intractable patients, what do I mean? People who have been into rehab 8 times, who would tell me, Dr. Mash, I'm not going to any meetings. I've done that. It doesn't work. To go from that to talking about what needed to happen now, what was going to be different this time, we saw this profound cognition enhancement, or what I like to call contemplative, ready for change. People went from just thinking about, yeah, I better do something now or I'm going to die, to changing it up and rewriting their own personal narrative and planning to make changes in their life that would keep them on the right track. And when we referred some of our patients for aftercare, because, of course, again, ibogaine's an addiction interrupter, you still got to hit the water and swim. You're going to get off the high dive of recovery, but if you don't swim when you hit the water, you'll go to the bottom of the pool. You have to work something post-ibogaine. But what Dr. Dolan is demonstrating in her animal studies is this window of neuroplasticity opens. That means whatever therapy you do, whatever work you do with your clinician, if you go into inpatient, if you're an outpatient and you're going to group meetings, the brain is ready. The synaptic plasticity has been turned on the brain. And I like to say neurons that fire together, wire together. So can we unlearn bad behaviors and start to get up in the morning, stand up straight and say, today, I'm going to live a day sober. Today, I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to go to a meeting. I'm going to connect with family and people that I love. I'm going to eat healthy. I'm going to start to do all of the behavioral changes that are going to give me a shot on goal that I can put together 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 10 years, a lifetime in recovery. A lifetime in recovery.
Right. I want to ask one last question before we wrap things up in our 30 minutes are up. One of those things is we have to make a point that we're going to try to make an effort to try to see if we can go ahead and get Dr. Dolan to out of her busy schedule to see if possibly we can go ahead and get her onto the program here. If that's something we can do, we're going to make our best effort to go make that possible, because that's somebody we definitely want to go and hear from, both of you speaking together on this subject. The one thing I'll make mention of is that for those that are listening right now, and maybe you might not have heard about ibogaine or you really haven't had much to learn about it, first of all, these two articles that we're referring to here on the program, we'll make sure to drop these into the show description for this particular episode. You make sure to go ahead and look at them for yourselves. But when it comes to those that want to try the treatment now, you make mention of where you had to go ahead and offer the treatment overseas. So for right now, you could go to, say, other countries where it's legal or unregulated, Mexico, Brazil, New Zealand, Canada, South America, South Africa are some of those mentioned by the New York Times. But they also mentioned how these private clinics often charge between $5,000 and $15,000 for a single treatment. That's just the treatment. That's not counting, you know, your accommodation airfare to go there. So there's a lot of investment to go for this. At this point, I mean, not a lot of people are going to be able to make that opportunity. Obviously, we're here on the program, Dr. Mash. You've already talked to some patients that have made that investment, but for those that can't make the investment, how important is it that here in the United States, we get more research done and we open the door for this treatment to be available in various controlled environments so that patients here can have a chance to recover and when other treatments have not worked?
It's something that I think about every day. The fact that the drug is not available in clinical trials in the U.S., the fact that we're not able to pick up the pace of clinical trial research in the United States, and the fact that it's not available for patients here in the United States is something that weighs heavy on my heart every single day. In St. Kitts, we had a sliding scale. We tried to scholarship a certain number of patients. people came and paid what they could, and we kept our doors open. And that's not a long-range business model for anyone. We need to have that public-private partnership. And the fact that Kentucky entertained the idea of using funds from the opioid abatement settlement to spearhead the research so that we could talk to the FDA and other clinicians, other stakeholders, to try to get these trials moving faster, I think is really the solution here. And all eyes now will be on Ohio. If we want to do this, if the National Institute on Drug Abuse would lend a hand and lend the leadership to help pick up the pace of research, it can happen. And right now, I think patients and the consumers are driving the interest. And certainly, again, I'll close with the idea that helping our veterans is something that's sacred to all of us. That's something we can get behind, and we need to do it. We need to pick up the pace. And patients that are looking, families that are looking for offshore treatments, please, I always stress, do your homework. Ask the right questions. Make sure that you don't put a loved one in harm's way.
I think that's a wonderful way to go ahead and end this episode and wrap this up for today. Dr. Mash, really appreciate you taking time out and getting a chance to go and hear from your perspective right here. Just because obviously with other guests and on, there's only so much time to have your input and what your expertise is, which is, you know, expansive. And, you know, it's a blessing and really a wonderful thing that we've been able to been so honored and privileged to have you here hosting this program for all of us here at Cannabis Radio, for listeners out there to go ahead and hear this message. So as always, thank you again for putting this on. And for those listeners, we want to thank you for listening to another edition of Psychedelic Breakthrough Addiction Therapies. And please come back and join us for our next episode.